Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who for the sake of the joy that was set before him endured the cross, disregarding its shame, and has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such hostility against himself from sinners, so that you may not grow weary or lose heart. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And you have forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as children, "My child, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, or lose heart when you are punished by him. For the Lord disciplines those whom he loves, and chastises every child whom he accepts." Endure trials for the sake of discipline. God is treating you as children. For what child is there whom a parent does not discipline? If you do not have that discipline in which all children share, then you are illegitimate and not his children. Moreover, we had human parents to discipline us, and we respected them. Should we not be even more willing to be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time, as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, in order that we may share his holiness. Now, discipline always seems painful rather than pleasant at the time, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Pursue peace with everyone, and the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and through it many became defiled. See to it that no one becomes like Esau, an immoral and godless person, who sold his birthright for a single meal. You know that later, when he wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no chance to repent, even though he sought the blessing with tears. You have not come to something that can be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that none another word be spoken to them, for they could not endure the order that was given, "If even an animal touches the mountain, it shall be stoned to death." Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, "I tremble with fear." But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. See that you do not refuse the one who is speaking, for if they did not accept, when they did not escape, when they refused the one who warned them on earth, how much less will we escape if we reject the one who warns from heaven? At that time his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, "Yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heaven." This phrase, "yet once more," indicates the removal of what is shaken, that is, created things, so that what cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us give thanks, by which we offer to God an acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for indeed our God is a consuming fire. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Okay, there we go. So as you recall from last week, chapter 11 was basically a catalog of faithful figures from Hebrew Scripture. And they were utilized as exemplars for this community that was really struggling with the suffering inflicted on them because of their faith. And we've talked about that a lot in the past. Persecution was increasing during this period of time. And basically the whole purpose of Hebrews is to try to encourage them and warn them of the consequences of remaining faithful or abandoning God. In 12, the author moves to a more pastoral rather than sort of explanatory form. And we see this in the fact that in chapter 11, it's all in third person, with a few exceptions. Chapter 12, it's a lot of first and second person plural singular pronouns. So he's addressing them directly now. He's getting personal. And he starts by saying, you know, as I just wrote, we're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. And I think it's instructive to realize that witness comes from the same Greek word from which we get the word martyr. Now, it's not to say that the people in chapter 11, for the most part, died because of their faith in the ways that martyrs do. But I think it's important to keep that association in our minds as we're reflecting on this section. And the first four verses or so are really kind of caught up in an athletic metaphor, which returns in verses 12 and 13. He talks about running with perseverance the race set before us. In verse 4, he says, in your struggle against sin, you have not resisted to the point of shedding your blood. So we have the idea of racing. We also have the idea of boxing. And he says in the second half of verse 1, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely. This is also part of the athletic metaphor. Because in the ancient world, when people competed in sports, they did it naked, so that their clothes would not hinder their freedom of movement. And to the author of Hebrews, this sin are like heavy garments that inhibit our range of motion. And so we have to shuck off that old life of sin, if you will, be reborn, to borrow a concept from John's Gospel. And when you're born, you're in a birthday suit. And so this is a metaphor that makes us feel vulnerable and embarrassed. And that's exactly what the author wants us to do. What he's basically saying to them, I know that you feel threatened. I know that you feel helpless. And you are, without the faith of Jesus. It's also, I think, wise to point out that when people were crucified, they were crucified naked to provide the maximum amount of humiliation to the person being crucified and the maximum amount of deterrence to the crowd watching the execution. So we've got this great cloud of witnesses, and that's very nice. But in verse 2, he says, listen, Abraham and Moses, they were great, but we really need to focus on Jesus, okay? Because he is qualitatively different from them. He transcends their faithfulness because his obedience was perfect. His willingness to sacrifice was perfect. Now, there's a slight controversy on how to translate the middle phrase, who for the sake of joy that was set before him endured the cross. Now, that can also be translated, who instead of the joy that was set before him endured the cross. And, of course, the meaning of that is very, very different. Who for the sake of joy points to this eschatological vision of salvation and the reconciliation of creation to God. If instead you translate the Greek instead of, then it talks about the joys that were available to him were he to resist the call to be crucified. I think within the context of Hebrews, I have to go against the translation that I myself read. I think the Greek should go instead of, and so does the commentaries that I've been studying. Just for the context, it goes better, because remember, he's trying to explain to the Hebrews, look, I know you want an easy life as you pursue your faith in Jesus, but in this society, you cannot have it both ways. You're going to have to choose. And so I think it makes more sense for the author to be saying, now look at Jesus. He could have had a nice, happy life, gotten married, had kids, you know, worked in the carpentry shop, died in his bed, surrounded by his loved ones. But no, he gave all that up so that he could complete his mission, which was to suffer And by doing that, he's been elevated to the right hand of God on his throne in heaven, where he serves, as we've read in previous chapters, as our intercessor. You know, Jesus' presence in heaven, for the author of Hebrews, is more significant than his crucifixion and resurrection. It is the climax of God's saving work. And then he goes on to 3 to make the point even more clearly. Consider him who endured such hostility against himself from sinners. So Jesus has been where you are, except in a more extreme way, because you've not shed a drop of blood. You know, and so don't give up. You know, no matter how exhausted you are, no matter how discouraged or frustrated you are, you can't give up on Jesus, because Jesus did not give up on you. He went to extremes, and you should be prepared to do the same. Verse 5 transitions into a new segment that will go on through verse 11. And it starts with a quotation from Proverbs chapter 3, verses 11 and 12. And basically, he's trying to explain why it is that they have to suffer because they're disciples of Jesus. And these verses essentially address the matter of theodicy. Now, theodicy is from a Greek word that breaks down into theo, which means God, and dike, which is justice. So theodicy deals with the justice of God, and it asks the question, if God is both good and all-powerful, then why do bad things happen to good people? And this would have been in the forefront of the minds of the community reading and listening to Hebrews. And basically, he sort of takes an Old Testament perspective that God punishes us to test and improve us, to help us mature. And as we'll see when we start our study on Romans in a couple of weeks, Paul separately makes roughly the same conclusions about the sufferings that Christians have to endure. And the quotation from Proverbs is significant because it starts with, "my child." So he's reminding them that they are children of God, and that is a terrific privilege. However, just as our earthly parents discipline us to keep us from self-inflicted harm, to delineate appropriate boundaries of behavior, which children need, God does the same. And unlike our human parents, who, as the author writes, they disciplined us as seemed best to them, God is the Father of spirits. And human parents are flawed. God isn't. God really knows what's best for us. He disciplines us for our good in order that we may share His holiness. And although discipline can be painful at first, it yields fruit over time. And on the second page of your notes at the very top, I've inserted a quotation from the author of one of the commentaries I consult, William Lane, the Word Biblical Commentary, and I think this just sums it up so well, I couldn't put it any better. Because, you know, you think, so God smites us so that we have the opportunity to prove that we're obedient and faithful. What kind of God is that? It's certainly not the type of God that is revealed through Jesus and His love and mercy. So this is Lane's take on it. And I'm reading it so the folks listening online can have this as well. "Responsibility for the infliction of suffering may be traced to those who are hostile to God, who find in the people of God a target for their hostility. Such sufferings become disciplinary in character when God makes them a means for maturing His children spiritually. The goal of divine discipline is Christian maturity and ultimately participation in the holiness of God. It is God's ability to transform an expression of hostility into a measure for spiritual nurture that is emphasized in chapter 12, verses 5 through 11. Okay? So what Lane is saying, and I agree with him, is that God isn't afflicting people with suffering. What's happening is that People are suffering because they follow Jesus. And the natural consequence of that is some people are going to hate them for it. Okay? And so, instead of causing it, God just doesn't stop it. Because in this persecution, God sees opportunity. God sees opportunity for growth and a more powerful witness. Because when people are being dispossessed of their property, when they're being exiled from their homes, when they're being possibly tortured or even threatened with death or killed, what that does is these sufferings reveal to the broader community, if people are willing to endure this for the sake of this Jesus person, there must really be something to it. Maybe we should check this out. Because remember, the Greek word for witness is the same root for the word martyr. Okay? So in 12, he goes back to the athletic metaphor that he started with at the opening of the chapter. And he's basically saying, get it together. Don't swerve from the straight path. Because the more you swerve, the more painful it's going to be. He says, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. So basically what he's saying is that the more you swerve from the path of Jesus, the more you refuse to follow Him, the pain that you experience now is only going to get worse. Because eventually, if you don't correct your running stance, an injury could turn into a dislocation. In this case for them, a dislocation from a loving and supportive community, dislocation from their relationship with God through Jesus. But Jesus can heal them, which empowers them to go on and pursue their faith avidly. In 14, we see a very sharp shift where the author starts to outline a vision for how the community can live faithfully and obediently in relationship with God in eschatological expectation, in the expectation of the fulfillment of the promise that has already been in part fulfilled for the people of the Christian community. And it starts by basically reminding them of things that they already knew. You know, if you go back to verse 5, it says, and have you forgotten? And so, 14, pursue peace with everyone and the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. I mean, he's already covered that previously, and that's something you might expect that they would already know. And the issue throughout, this passage is they need to correct their behavior in a way that's appropriate for people who are children of God. Everything is on the line. Absolutely everything. And it's win or lose. I mean, this is one of those occasions where it's a black and white situation. There are no shades of gray. They're either going to be faithful or they're going to be apostate. Okay? And apostasy is a central concern in Hebrews. You see it illustrated most powerfully in chapter 3, verses 7 through 19. And apostasy is not, as we think of it today, a deviation from a doctrine of the church. Okay? Like, someone who didn't believe in the Trinity would be considered apostate. Okay? That's a core theological doctrine. What the author of Hebrews is pointing to is something much more fundamental than that. When he talks about apostasy, he's talking about deviating from reality itself. Because God is reality. And we're being invited into God's reality. Okay? And this reality is grounded in peace. And I've included another quotation from Lane in your notes, which again, if you'll be patient, I'll read for the benefit of our online audience. Peace is not simply harmony within the community or in personal relationships. In this context, peace is an objective reality that results from the redemptive accomplishment of Christ. Peace denotes the objective basis of the solidarity of the community. It is an expression of the reality of Christ's accomplishment. Peace is to be actively pursued because it is also exhibited in the solidarity of responsibility for the welfare of one another. And we see this in verses 15 and 16. See to it that no one fails. See to it that no one becomes like Esau. If we don't see to it, no one will see the Lord. And what does that mean? It means that contrary to our modern, highly individualistic attitude when it comes to our relationship with God, we either make it or we don't as a community. Because if we allow our brothers and sisters to fail in the faith, we will be held responsible by God. And so what the author of Hebrews is arguing, and you can argue against him if you so choose, is that we're in this together. And we're going to go through the gates of heaven arm in arm, or none of us are going to go at all. That is a radical claim in a culture that obsessively repeats, do you have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ? Now, it's all well and good to have that personal relationship. That's what the author of Hebrews is begging us to get. But outside the context of a covenant community, it is largely meaningless. Which is why in chapter 10, he chided them. Get together. Get together. Come together to worship. Because it's only there that you can experience and express your true identity as children of God. And I'm not just emphasizing that because I'm a priest and I want you in church. It's this is the author of Hebrews talking. When it talks about this holiness, which enables us to see God, a God that the Old Testament witness reveals cannot be seen, this holiness is not something we achieve on our own. I mean, I think we talk about holiness from the standpoint of
being good,
yeah, being pious and stuff like that. But holiness is not something we can manufacture. It is a gift of grace, and this gift is the sanctifying power of Christ that comes through His sacrifice, that comes through His presence at the right hand of God in heaven. And sanctifying just means to be made holy. It's something that cleanses and elevates us. And, you know, the concern that the author has is the fact that apostasy is contagious. You know, one bad apple can ruin an entire bushel. If you've ever gotten some strawberries that had a molded strawberry on the bottom, and you didn't realize it until 2 or 3 days after you bought it, and then half the carton's ruined and you paid $5 for it. I mean, you know, because most of the time we talk about bad apples, and we don't get to the second half of the aphorism, can ruin the entire bushel. You know, so just as faith can be contagious, apostasy can be contagious as well. And I think it's also important to note that in this chapter, when the author of Hebrews talks about sin, we do tend to think, as we do with holiness, that sin is about choices, that it's about certain activities, whether we check off all the appropriate boxes on the do and don'ts list. And that's true. That's true. That's not how sin's being referred to here, though. In chapter 12, sin talks about the very essence of sin itself. Okay? So the foundation of our sin is our disrupted relationship with God, which is fundamentally caused because of our desire to be God, to have the control, to have the power, and not to have to obey God, not to have to be loyal to a covenant that can prove inconvenient, if not painful. So this counterpoint in chapter 12 between sin as a very foundational reality and holiness, two things that transcend discrete choices and events in our lives, but really get down to the very roots of where all of that comes from, I think that's worth paying attention to. And then he goes to Esau. You remember from last year when we studied Genesis, before we studied Exodus and got into Hebrews, Esau made a bad call. He had been out hunting. He comes in. His brother Jacob, whose name you may recall in Hebrew means trickster, he's making some lentil stew. And Esau's really hungry. And he trades his birthright as the eldest for a pot of stew. And this is sort of the counterpoint to all the good examples we read about in chapter 11. This is your negative counterpoint example. And you can read about this in Genesis chapter 25, verses 29 to 34, which is where Esau trades out his birthright for lentil stew. I mean, I would have at least held out for a steak. I don't know about y'all. And then in chapter 27 of Genesis, verses 1 through 40, you see the story where Jacob, through deception, in collaboration with his mother, receives the blessing instead of Esau. And then when Esau came to get the blessing from his father Isaac, Isaac said, you know, I got nothing left. You know, I only have one blessing to give, and your brother tricked me and he already got it. And what does he tell him? He says, you'll be cursed to serve as a servant of your brother forever. And so, continuing on this theme that was started from the quotation from Proverbs 3 in verse 5, he's saying, you can't afford to be a child like Esau. Because if you do, you will sacrifice the blessing and you will be cursed. So, he's building his argument brick by brick, reinforcing through this marvelous structure. And you know, you can't give it up for nothing. And so, just because you're hungry, just because you're afraid, you have to look long term, not short term. You know, we're in a culture of immediate gratification, very short term oriented. We got to play the long game. And because this chapter is all about endurance, why you need to endure, how you can endure, what will happen if you do endure, what will happen if you don't endure. I mean, he's been riding this pony for a while, but he's really putting the whip to it in chapter 12. So to continue to build that argument, in verses 18 through 24, he compares two mountains, Sinai and Zion. He doesn't actually mention Sinai, but it's quite clear what he's referring to from Exodus and Leviticus and Deuteronomy. In verse 18, he begins to describe how God's presence manifested itself to the Israelites in the Sinai wilderness on top of Mount Sinai. And it was terrifying. You have this cloud and this lightning and it gets dark and the earth is shaking and people are warned that don't come close to the mountain because if you do, you'll die or you'll be stoned to death, depending upon which version of the events you read. And it even says that Moses was afraid, which is a little license the author of Hebrews taken, that nowhere in the Old Testament does it clearly say that Moses himself was afraid. But what he's trying to emphasize is that in the Old Covenant, which Jesus has fulfilled and transcended and made redundant. In the Old Covenant, there was this terrific distance between God and human beings. I mean, don't even come close to the mountain where I am, because that is a risky business. So you contrast that with Mount Zion, where you've got a heavenly Jerusalem, innumerable angels, festal gathering. It's night and day. It's night and day. And so what he's trying to explain to them is we're really quite fortunate because unlike our ancestors, who, by the way, were faithful to God no matter what, they had this terrific distance between themselves and God. We, on the other hand, have the opportunity to draw very close to God through Jesus, who became a human being so that we could relate to God better, and who now sits with God begging for our redemption. So when you compare the two, you realize how very fortunate you are to be heirs of this new covenant. But there's a catch. The joy of God is balanced by the judgment of God. And so in verse 25, see that you do not refuse the one who is speaking. And he's not talking about himself. He's talking about God. And he takes a verse or two from Haggai, and sort of Haggai chapter 2, verse 6, and he sort of puts it into the mouth of God. It's sort of like an Old Testament prophetic oracle, okay, where the author is channeling the oracle of God. So he says, make sure you listen to God, because if the Israelites were punished and didn't escape judgment with the covenant they had with God, which interposed a significant difference between them and God, when you consider how much better the new covenant through Jesus is, what do you think God's going to do to us if we fall short? Okay? Then he goes on in verse 26 to talk about the last day, the day of judgment, where God's promised that he'll shake not just the earth but the heaven. And this shaking is just a metaphor for God's judgment. Jesus uses in a parable the idea of the threshing floor. You know, you have to separate the chaff from the actual grain, and it's done through a process of shaking. All right, and once it's been shaken, some will be removed, and some will remain. Okay. And then in verse 28, he very abruptly shifts from this, you know, scare your pants off kind of stuff to say, so anyway, things are good, and so we should give thanks and worship with reverence and awe, for indeed our God is a consuming fire. And that last phrase, which just fascinates me, I think when you read that, you automatically think burning bush. But actually, where this is taken from is Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 3. You know, and it sort of connects back in verse 18, where he talks about God manifesting as a blazing fire. It's not that that manifestation of God was in any way deceptive or inaccurately described. This God is still a consuming fire. And so we need to be wary. We need to approach God without a lot of familiarity. Okay, familiarity breeds contempt. And you often do see this in the church, where since we do have access to God the Father through Jesus Christ by the facilitation of the Holy Spirit, we think of Jesus as our buddy. You know. That, I think, reflects an absence of awe and wonder and reverence before the majesty and sovereign might of God. I had a professor in seminary. He was one of these people who could sleep 3 or 4 hours a night and was still sharp as a tack. And so, you know, a lot of times I'd take a walk on the back circle to sort of clear my mind in the middle of writing an essay, and I'd see that his office light was on, and I'd go in and we'd talk. And I can't remember the context, but at some point he says, you know what bothers me is people who call Jesus their friend. And I said, well, but Jesus said, I no longer call you servants, I call you friends in the Gospel of John. He says, that's true. He says, but the preponderance of evidence is that he's called master or teacher or Lord. And he says, Jesus is not my friend. Jesus is not my buddy. He is so much more than that, for I am far from equal to him. And so I think what, in wrapping up chapter 12, the author of Hebrews is trying to do, is he's saying, we have this access. We have to honor it for what it is. Okay? Don't get too familiar. So I think I got it all. It is a stuffed chapter. And the reason being, I mean, like most books, especially the letters, which, remember, Hebrews is not. It's a sermon, not a letter. The last chapter sort of tails off a little bit. And there's a lot of goodies in chapter 13, so come on back next week. But chapter 12 is the climax of this sermon. You know, in fact, some scholars believe that originally it was the end of Hebrews. Because there's a measure of discontinuity when you get into 13. And, you know, you talk about stopping on a strong point that leaves people speechless and breathless, then that's the end of 12, for indeed our God is consuming fire. But we'll talk about that next week when we do 13. So, what are you thinking? David?
Verses 5 and 6 are really hard.
5 and 6?
Yeah, the whole thing about before we do not make light of the Lord's discipline, do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves. Part of me on one level says, okay, I understand it. Part of me says, I have no clue when God's disciplining me sometimes, and when I just have a bad case of the flu.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean? Yeah. How do I know?
That's a good question. I would distinguish between the natural sufferings of life and the sufferings that we endure for the sake of the cross of Christ. Because when Jesus in the gospel speaks of, if anyone wants to follow me and become my disciple, they must lose their life, take up their cross, and follow me. Okay? And he's not saying to follow me, you're going to have to stub your toe from time to time or lose your job or wreck your car. He's talking about suffering endured for a specific purpose. And that's what the author of Hebrews is talking about here. He's got a group of people who are kind of drawing back from the broader community because every time they engage, they're getting spit in the face. They're taking a risk. Part of their job as disciples is to spread the good news, to be evangelists. But they feel like that's too dangerous. In fact, they're not even willing to gather together as a community, some of them, because they don't want to be conspicuous. And so what I would say is that when we suffer for the sake of the cross of Christ, it is a discipline that God is utilizing to help us mature through that experience so that we receive the reward. The hostility doesn't come from God. It comes from people who despise what we stand for as Christians. And you know, God's disciplining of us, it doesn't come from a place of cruelty. I mean, I discipline my children, but I don't like it. Okay? It's unpleasant because I get quite a bit of feedback when I do. But it's necessary. I would be an irresponsible parent if I didn't discipline them. They wouldn't turn out well if I didn't discipline them. And it shows a commitment that God has to us that even though he loves us, he's prepared to allow us to suffer so that we can grow up into solid citizens of the kingdom. So, I mean, it gives me the willies too, David. It really does. But I think Hebrews does a decent job of explaining the purpose behind God doing this, and that it's indirect. You know, God basically, you know, if you're following Jesus, you are going to suffer. And when you got the flu, you know, I would argue maybe that's not suffering for the sake of Jesus. Maybe when you're trying to articulate a witness of God's love and mercy, and simply because you don't worship as others do, you're told you're going to go to hell. Maybe that's suffering for the sake of the cross of the Christ. Conversely, if you engage with an atheist who tells you what an idiot you are, how gullible and ignorant you must be to buy in to this ridiculous false mythology that miracles can happen and people can be raised from the dead. You know, I thought you were better, David. I really did. You seemed like a smart guy. These are the types of sufferings. Or if you're engaged in a ministry, you know, When ministry gets tough, people tend to run away. And the hardest ministries to recruit for are the ones that require continual in-depth engagement. So Sunday school teachers have to be here pretty much every week. And they have to spend about an hour to prepare for this. If you're going to work with the youth group, you're going to have to be here 2-3 times a month for a couple of hours, plus some events that take the better part of a day. If you're going to be a member of the vestry for 3 years, you're going to have a meeting once a month that lasts anywhere from 90 minutes to 3 hours, and in between those meetings, you've got work to do. Okay? And so, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. But more often than not, and I include myself in this as well, when the going gets tough, most people run like hell. We go in a different direction, you know. And so, in your life of faith, when you suffer, attempt to discern, and it's not always easy, whether what you're going through is yielding fruit for God. If it is, then this suffering is discipline from God designed to strengthen you. Yeah, John.
Well, I find it interesting what caught my eye going through this. I think if you talk to most people, mm-hmm. they would say that their faith between themselves and God.
Yeah.
Okay, and the wake-up call, I think, for everybody is a line that basically says, see to it that no one fails.
Yeah.
So I look back at myself. Now, mm-hmm. I have a daughter who is going to church, doing all the things,
good.
Has a strong faith.
Mm-hmm.
I have two sons that are not there.
Mm.
So this tells me that I must get going and somehow get them, whatever way I can, turned around like they were when they were young kids and not in their 30s.
Yeah.
So that is a challenge. I think many of us at times believe it's just between us and God. It's really not.
Yeah. And, you know, and you can't pin all the responsibility for that on yourself either, because you raised them as best as you could to be faithful to God in worship, faithful to a community covenant. And when they get grown, they make choices of their own for a variety of different reasons. I mean, the church, with a capital C, as a whole, is also not seeing to them. We're not articulating the gospel in a way that's intelligible and accessible for them. My encouragement, if any of you have children who aren't currently connecting with their faith within the context of a community, find some indirect means, because you're their mom, you're their dad, and the harder you push, the harder they're going to push you back. So be clever. Be clever about it. You know, find somebody that you know can get to them and put them up to it.
Or just pray for somebody to come.
You can.
That's happened with our daughter-in-law. Yeah. That happened with our daughter-in-law. She was not baptized, and it was not up to us. We couldn't possibly say anything to her. But I prayed, when I realized that, I prayed, send someone. And someone came, took her to their church, and that kind of opened the door for her. And later on then, and our son went to that church with her, even though he couldn't stand it, because it was very fundamental, and he was raised as Episcopalian, and it just, he missed everything about the Episcopal Church. But he went with her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, just to make a long story short, she wanted he wanted our granddaughter to be baptized, and she said, I want to be baptized with her. Mm-hmm. But it all happened because someone else came to her
mm-hmm.
and opened that door.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it, someone once told me that they prayed for a loved one. I'm being as vague as possible. That they prayed for a loved one for 20 years to reconnect with God through worship. And it happened. 20 years is an awfully long time to wait. But it's only half what Israel had to do in the wilderness.
Right.
So count yourselves lucky.
Yeah. But that's the faithful witness. That prayer is a faithful witness.
Yeah.
You know, but that's such a true thing, Judy, that you have sometimes other people connect better.
Yes.
Yeah, as a baseball coach, and I coached both sons through baseball numerous years, I could tell them to hold his bat, come through, never happen. Another guy, another dad, could come up to him and say, hold your bat like this and go through, and he doesn't. So there is a lot of truth to that statement, that sometimes it's not us, it's someone else who could take that role.
And it's not passing the buck, it's delegation, and it's also just being smart about the best way, to connect this person with a loving community of faith. You know, so often we're very ham-fisted, you know. All you really need is a rock band and people will come flocking to your door, or build it and they will come. Well, it's nonsense. You know, people come to church seeking God for a whole complex of different reasons, and sometimes they don't even know why they came. They don't even know. It was a subconscious, gut, impulsive kind of thing, which is beautiful. It's spirit-led. And so we have to be nimble. We have to be adaptive. And sometimes maybe it is a rock band. And building things doesn't hurt. But, you know, people are nuanced. The gospel is nuanced. And so we have to be prepared to be subtle and forthright, depending on the circumstances. Jen?
This reminds me, and we've already discussed this once, St. Augustine, in his Confessions, you talk about somebody who was patient, his mother, for 40 years.
Yeah.
She had this plan for her son, and he just totally lived opposite, you know, just a wild and crazy life.
Yeah.
And then getting close to the time, and his Confessions are just wonderful to read. His story is an autobiography, so to speak. And then he finally does, and his mother didn't live much longer after that, but he's very grateful that she did live to see him actually come over and come to God in such a big way. And sometimes that is what happens, resist, people trying to make you change. And it's just the same stories. And then something that, you know, is probably a God thing turns.
And do you remember what he identified as the tipping point for him in his conversion process? Pop quiz.
No, I mean, I've been reading this for about 4 or 5 years, a little bit at a time.
Yeah, it's pretty thick.
It's reading it in the old English, which
is even thicker. Yeah, that's the edition I've read. Well, the story he tells is that he was in a garden, and he actually had some scripture with him, and because he'd been searching, and there's a little child, he can't see him, who is sort of singing tole lege, which means pick up and read. You know, I mean, was it an angel? Was it happenstance? Was it even accurate? Who knows? I mean, everybody fudges a little on their own autobiography, but yeah, I mean, he was a bad boy. I mean, he was a bad boy. And, you know, if you're going to go in to read the Confessions, the thing that you need to realize is that you are dealing with a man who is severely neurotic 1,500 years before Freud was on the scene. I mean,
thanks to his mother, probably.
He beats himself raw. And but it is a marvelously instructive piece. And the chapter on time is brilliant. Absolutely fascinating. So you never really know, and you know, that's why you have to be vigilant and aware, because the simplest kindness
a word that we might never remember having said or thought was largely insignificant can make a huge difference. And it's persisting in emulating Jesus, allowing him to live in us, that leads people to Christ. So, yes, sir. Moses.
You know, we have three children that are grown up now.
Mm-hmm.
We have two sons. I think when our children were still young, there was such great hope, you know, for us. Of course, as they grow up, you know, when we came to the United States of America, I remember my oldest son was very, I shouldn't say outspoken, but he just told us when he was 17 years old, we were here, he said that to me, "Dad, you know, I'm looking forward to turning 18.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "After I've turned 18, I'm in college, I'll never put my foot in church anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I've had too much church." And he made it clear to me that I'm preaching the gospel and telling people that Jesus said that whosoever will, but I'm forcing them to go to church, so I'm doing exactly the opposite of what Jesus does. So anyway, and as sure as sure can be, when he turned 18, went to college, just turned that way.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, actually, both of them.
Mm.
And this older one actually ended in prison, and this other one, actually, both of them, became addicts. But so there was a big question, you know, in our hearts, you know, with Susan, you know, you're kind of like, what is it that we can do? Not maybe what is it what we have done, but of what is it that we didn't do, we did not do. Yeah. And we actually even blamed ourselves on this and that and the other. Mm. But the great thing is that my kids, even if they went that way, or they've gone that way, they've always made sure that they let us know that this is what we know, and this is who you are, we've chosen ourselves to go that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I started learning that everything that I am, it's God's grace. I haven't earned it, and I cannot earn it. I can't claim anything,
mm-hmm.
really.
Yeah.
And whatever God does, it's His own prerogative. God does what He does, not what I think He should do.
Yeah.
And so I've accepted that. But thank God that God is now kind of really bringing them back after the. You know, they've got a lot of knockings. Life has mm-hmm. got that. It has some, you know, it teaches. It's a very painful lesson, but it does teach them. So now they're coming back and say, you know, we know the God that you have told us. So it's a painful thing. But I'm looking at what you have said this morning. In terms of that 12th chapter,
mm-hmm.
that the Hebrew writer says, we should look to Jesus,
mm-hmm.
and fix our eyes on Him, about all the other witnesses. And then there in chapter 5, verse 7 to 10, that I can't understand how God's Son can suffer so much, but it's God teaching Him obedience through suffering.
Yeah. That's a mysterious passage in chapter 5, verse 7, where, you know, Jesus, well, actually it's verse 8 of chapter 5, although He was a son, He learned obedience through what He suffered. I mean, if He's the Son of God, as we're told in the opening verses of Hebrews, then why would He need to learn obedience to Himself? I mean, when you think of a Trinitarian theology where Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are all one God, three different persons and with a relationship so dynamic, I think that, you know, in Hebrews, the author wants to stress the full humanity of Jesus. He needs that to construct his argument, and it happens to be true. He is also writing at a time when there were a variety of perspectives of whether or not Jesus actually was a human being or not. Some people thought that he only appeared to be a human being, that, you know, God had kind of faked us out, which of course leaves you with a deceptive God who's not worthy of your worship. So I think what he was saying is that, you know, the divine Jesus was naturally inclined to accomplish the mission set forth from the Father, despite how horrific it was. But the human Jesus, who never sinned, as the text says later on, he still had to grapple with the same sort of sufferings that we did. You know, he's forwarding Jesus as the exemplar of what being a child of God really means. And, you know, you do your best, you hope for the best when you're raising children. But this is the way I try to think about it. You know, because I wonder, you know, I have priest kids, you know, and when they get out of the house, they're going to go to church. Or are they going to go to church, you know, in a different tradition, which might have very different values than mine. But I liken it to, you can stack the deck for your friend. Whether they play the hand right or not is totally up to them.
I think 18, thereabouts, is the age when children go off on their own to become their own, apart from their parents. They're searching for their own faith, not the faith of their parents.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they go into the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
And they wander in the wilderness.
Which isn't necessarily a bad place to be.
It's not a bad place to be. And that's where they learn lessons. And if they've had the right foundation, whether they have been happy on that foundation or not, whether you think they haven't listened, they have. They've absorbed it.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, they'll come back. Eventually, they'll come to the promised land. That doesn't mean that we can't stop praying for them, because the sooner it happens, the better off they're going to be. You know, but this happens. And even if they don't follow your own faith tradition, if they're following their concept and their belief in God, praise God.
Yeah.
Praise God.
Well, and the most powerful witness that we can make is simply to allow the incarnate Jesus to become incarnate through us. And, you know, so forgiveness, peace, perspective, proper priorities, a sense of joy, of endurance through sufferings, encouragement. When we live a life that embodies Jesus, there's something attractive about that, like a flame for a moth. And those are really the best evangelists. The best evangelists are not the people who go over to the worker in the cubicle next to them and put them in a half Nelson until they agree to come to church. Okay, that is counterproductive. The best evangelist is someone who illustrates the love of Jesus in a distinct way that causes people to notice and say, I want what they've got. Peter.
I also think that marriage and children are great evangelism, because I wonder how many people I know. I went to church when I was at boarding school in England, mm-hmm. twice a day, and then if I got confirmed, I had to go three times on a Sunday. And when I'd been there from the age of 8 until 18, I came out, and I think I'd had enough church for my whole life. You know, it's pretty true. And reality, you know, I go home at Christmas, go off to church, a few pints of beer, and go down to the midnight service. That's the way Church of England operates. But when we got married and had children, that was when the calling came back to come back to church. And I don't think Lewis and I are unique in that way. I think there's a lot. The kids have a big thing to do with bringing their parents back.
Yeah, although
for the sake of the children too.
For the sake of the children.
For the sake of the children, not necessarily your own. No. For the sake of the children.
Increasingly, though, that's less true. I mean, you just look at the percentages on the surveys in terms of generationally where each generation is with claiming some sort of religious affiliation, and the last two generations has been very low, Xers and millennials are very suspicious of institutions and organizations, and that's certainly how they view the church, and that's partly our fault, because we do not look, and oftentimes we do not act as a movement or as an organism, which is what we are as a community, as the body of Christ. And they have absorbed this very individualistic concept, and they honestly are more focused on setting up their children for economic success by ensuring that they excel at school than they are anything else. The vast majority of parents take their kids to the soccer game at 9 o'clock on Sunday, and they don't care. If it wasn't a soccer game, they were going to stay at home anyway. And, you know, and it's something that we have to figure out how to provide a witness that's sufficiently compelling that says nothing is more important than this. You know, that's one of the central messages of Hebrews, and really every book of the Bible. Nothing is more important than this. Not soccer, not swimming, not scholarships, not college admissions. I certainly understand the motive. I'm thrilled that Emma can throw a discus, 72 feet. You know, she nearly broke the middle school record as a sixth grader. I mean, and I can't wait for the spring season to start. Because I'm already thinking, cha-ching, partial track scholarship. Woo! It's almost an obsession. It's driven by fear, and to a certain extent by this apprehension of guilt that if we don't provide our child with every advantage and opportunity, then we will regret it, because in the future they will be miserable. Yes?
Could you say a few words about being surrounded by the great cloud of witnesses?
Yes. We use this in the preface to the Sanctus and the Great Thanksgiving at Communion. And specifically here, he's referring to the righteous of former generations that he discussed in chapter 11. And but he means more than just the people who were named in that catalog. He's talking about all the people who throughout the centuries have been faithful to God in their covenant with Him, old or new. And the sense is, I preach this consistently at funerals, is that we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, because we tend to think of heaven as a place, okay? Pearly gates and streets of gold and all this stuff. I don't think of heaven as a place. I think of heaven as wherever God dwells. Just in the same way that I don't view a building as my home. I view my home as where my family is. And, the building is just there to do its thing. So I think when we die and we're accepted by God into His immediate presence and into His kingdom, we dwell with God. God is omnipresent, which means that God can be everywhere all the time. And if
the loved ones who have gone before are with God and God is with us, then they too surround us as a great cloud of witnesses. Okay? And, you know, some people would contest that. But I've aligned my view with that of the Eastern Orthodox churches, the term just slipped out of my brain. The harder I try to remember it, the less likely I will be to remember it. But I think that's a comfort to us, that not only are we not separated from God, we have access to God, but we're not entirely separated from the people who have gone before us. That's an encouragement. It's a comfort. And it's also part of a promise that if we, like them, remain faithful, we too will someday become part of that great cloud of witnesses which worship around the throne of God, to borrow some language from Revelation. And then we in turn can be present both with God and those who are living their life now. Because heaven is not separate from earth. It's a both-and thing. You know, we're talking about this eschatological expectation, waiting for the fulfillment of God's kingdom at the end of time. But that's already been partially fulfilled through Jesus now. Okay? Someday it will be completed. It's a concept called already, not yet.
Yeah.
Okay, you may be familiar with that, especially if you've ever studied Paul. It's already, not yet. So we're kind of in the in-between times. And I don't know if that answers your question about the great cloud of witnesses, but that's my belief. Yeah.
I think in that verse 22 of chapter 12, that concept that you talked about in Mount Zion and Mount Sinai, mm-hmm. it's like there's an assembly.
Mm-hmm.
Mount Zion, the worshipers.
Yeah.
It's not the concept of just the place, as you said.
Yeah. Well, and the word assembly in Greek is ekklesia.
Yeah.
From which we get the word ecclesiastical. And so basically, it means the same thing as church.
Yeah.
It has the same connotation as church. That's not an exact translation, but it could just as easily be translated as church. They wanted to stay tight, so they translated it as assembly. You can also translate it as gathering. Oh, I'm sorry. Susan, fire away.
Why not the scripture that makes me most nervous is the last verse in the
11th
chapter.
Yeah.
These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what they had been promised. God has done something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect.
Yes.
I think it refers to that communal testimony you were talking about, that there are things we do not, our faith is not experienced purely at personal, but at the communal level.
Yes, and what he's talking about in the final two verses of chapter 11 is that our ancestors under the Old Covenant were commended for their faith, for their fidelity to God, but they never got what was promised to them. You know, Abram and his heirs never got the land. And once they got the land, eventually it was taken away from them. And they went back, but they were always under the thumb of a foreign ruler, and then eventually the Romans dispersed them and completely decentralized the community. But what he's saying here is that God's provided us something better so that they would not, apart from us, be made perfect. So basically, what the author of Hebrews is saying is that they're grandfathered in, okay? And you see that in the Apostles' Creed, in that very peculiar phrase where we talk about, and he descended to hell, talking about Jesus. After the crucifixion, he descended to hell. I think the reference, and it's just a single verse, is maybe in 1st or 2nd Timothy. I'm sorry, I can't remember right now. But the idea was is that Jesus went to Hades, which was sort of the Jewish conception of what happened when you died if you were bad. Otherwise, you went to the bosom of Abraham. If you look at the lessons we had a few weeks ago for St. Francis Day, Lazarus and the rich man, basically Jesus went down to Hades, and the righteous that were there, he brought up. So Jesus is the culmination of a covenant that God has developed with a chosen people for millennia. But there were limitations on the original covenant. It's almost like a process. You know, God couldn't start out with Israel by teaching them calculus. Okay? Because this was a new thing, this idea that there's only one God. Okay? He had to start with arithmetic. And then he had to go to algebra, and then trigonometry, and then to calculus. Jesus is calculus.
Okay? Hebrews, the author of Hebrews, did the same thing in his sermon. He started out with the foundation and built on that. So he did the very same thing, because he couldn't just jump right into it. He had to lay the foundation for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's very elegant, you know, and humbling, you know.
And when you look at Revelation, the same thing happens there with level upon level upon level. You can't get to the end unless you go with the levels. You can't really understand it unless you just follow along. A little bit like C.S. Lewis leads you around the garden path. Mm-hmm. But if you keep following him, eventually you get to where he wants you to be.
Yeah. Well, and once we're done with this, I thought about doing it literally as a class session, but I thought, no, I could be prosecuted under the UN prohibition on torture. But here's what I'd encourage you to do. When we're finished with Hebrews, go home. It'll probably take about an hour. Sit down with Hebrews, now that we've gone through it chapter by chapter and sort of talked about it and pulled it apart a little bit. Get you a nice hot cup of tea and read it aloud in one sitting. Okay? And because the structure is incredibly elegant, and you will get a pronounced sense of what he's doing once you see how he builds the argument. Plus, it's just a great review. I plan on doing it. So, it's 11:05. I've really enjoyed this, and I hope you have too. I'll see you next week for Hebrews 13. In 2 weeks, we'll start with an introduction and, if possible, a review of the first chapter of Paul's letter to the Romans. Let us pray.